Welcome back to Aberdeen Proving Grounds Hidden History. I am your host, the Reverend Sean, Little Sean, with my co-host, Miss Susan Thompson.
Hi, Reverend. You are wearing black today, so it's quite fitting.
I think we need to get you a new moniker as well.
Well, you know, one of us has to be the more reasonable one of the two.
And Susan, thank you for the title of today's episode. Edgewood Arsenal, it's a gas, gas, gas.
That's right. We have to get our little rock and roll hidden in there somewhere.
And Susan, where do we begin?
Well, Sean, I think we're going to go back to a name that we've talked about a lot, not only in the last episode, but in the last season as well. And that's the name of Cadwallader. So the Cadwalladers were a fairly prominent family in early Philadelphia. There's a lot of Johns and Thomases in succession, so it gets a little confusing when you're talking names because it's John and then Thomas. And
just
then
a little. I mean, I'm going through, and they need to put a 1, 2, and a 3, and at least a 4 behind some of these.
Right, but we'll start our story, since we, again, are celebrating the Army's 250th birthday, with the Revolutionary War era John Cadwallader. And he had met George Washington.
Get out.
Nope. He was introduced by his father-in-law, who was quite a wealthy man, in 1769. And from that point forward, George and John were pretty good friends. And John had a commission during the Revolutionary War, and he was actually instrumental during the crossing of the Delaware, and
wow,
he provided some notes to George Washington over the position of the British troops in Princeton, was considered a very instrumental part of the war.
So if he's in Philadelphia, what brings him to Maryland?
His wife owned a plantation in Kent Island. We've heard this story so many times. There's quite a strong connection between Aberdeen Proving Ground and Kent County, Maryland, because they're just separated by the water. And as we've talked about before, the water was a main source of transportation. So though he was firmly established in Philadelphia, his father-in-law had bought him a very swanky property.
Swanky.
Yes, they were importing goods from England, which caused some problems because
Were they coming into Philadelphia?
Yes, they were elaborately decorating their new mansion, getting all the portraiture done. But they were also upset about all the taxes from the British. They were firmly on the Patriot side. And George Washington himself even called John Cadwallader a military genius.
Oh, wow. How come I've never heard of him before then?
Well, he didn't continue to participate in the war much after 1778 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Like he declined 2 subsequent appointments later in the war. So
okay,
he was basically just, you know, providing advice and guidance, although he did end up dueling and shooting someone over the honor of George Washington.
Well, of course.
So that's always fun when you have some dueling. And the man's name was Thomas Conway.
It was
called Conway's Cabal, and he was accused of trying to dethrone Washington as the general of the American army.
And during the duel, I believe he shot him in the mouth?
Shot him in the jaw and came out. He survived. He actually lived longer than John Cadwallader, but he did write an apology to George Washington over his perceived slight.
That'll keep your mouth shut, too.
So the Cadwalladers were a kind of fiery Welsh family by descent. But John Cadwallader ended up dying pretty early at the age of 44 after he caught pneumonia while duck hunting in Kent County.
Yikes.
But the ducks continue to play a role in American history, in APG's history, in the family's history. So we will jump a couple generations to John's grandson, whose name was George Cadwallader, most likely named for George Washington.
Uh-huh.
He was one of 5 brothers, but he was a lawyer. He was also had an early military commission, and he was quite a real estate developer and purchaser. Starting in the 1840s, at the time he was also serving in the Mexican-American War, he started buying property of what was called the Gunpowder Neck.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point, he owned the largest single parcel of land within the state of Maryland.
Okay.
It was 8,000 to 9,000 acres. It was the entirety of the Gunpowder Neck, which is now what is Edgewood.
Because he was a Civil War officer, correct?
Right. He was a Civil War officer, and actually he benefited quite a bit from his property at what is now Edgewood, mm-hmm. which was called Maxwell Point.
Oh, okay. Maxwell Point again.
It was originally a hunting club. He bought it. He kind of expanded it into a mansion. It was kind of a summer house, but not only that.
Oh.
George was kind of a wild child. He was married, but he openly kept his mistress at the house at Maxwell Point.
Whoa.
It's written about that, you know, without pretense, he openly keeps his mistress at this house. It was demolished in the 1920s, mm-hmm. so we just have some sort of blurry pictures of it.
But it wasn't like a mansion that you would think of as a mansion today.
No,
it was more of like...
I mean, his properties in Philadelphia was much more elaborate. Mm-hmm. But what he concentrated on was the landscape. He created an arboretum around his house. He was bringing in specimen trees. He planted a peach orchard. He planted an apple orchard. He had these large, like, the Cedar of Lebanon, which was an enormous tree, which was sort of the hallmark of the property, but just not only brought in all these exotic plants, but also brought in exotic animals, mostly birds, golden pheasants mm-hmm. and pigeons to shoot. He created a deer park around this property. But as you said, he was a major general during the Civil War. He was down in Corinth, Mississippi, when they were sieging that town, but he relied on the produce and meats from his farm to keep him fed during the Civil War.
Okay.
So he was really using the property, even though it wasn't his main residence, he was very much a presence here. And as I said, he owned like 40 miles of waterfront, it was. And they there were active hunting going on. So, you know, the duck hunting, he was a big duck hunting fan. And so that's...
And there's photographs of George Cadwallader.
Yes. From the Civil War, he has quite the wild hairdo.
I was ready to say, this gentleman should have invested in some combs.
So though he wasn't stationed here during the war, he was further south, there were some other Civil War activities that took place at Edgewood, notably the raid by Harry Gilmore.
There he is again, Harry Gilmore.
You can't get away from
him. You cannot. If you're from Maryland, you're very familiar with Harry Gilmore, because even though Maryland was with the Union during the Civil War, Harry Gilmore was a Confederate. And his family home was where Lock Raven Reservoir is today.
Right. And he was involved in an attack under the direction of Jubal Early, where they were trying to take Washington, basically liberate prisoners that were being held in very southern Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So while Jubal Early's troops were down there trying to do that, it didn't succeed, just in case you didn't read ahead.
I didn't read ahead, so I'm on the edge of my seat.
Harry Gilmore was coming up through Baltimore County, through Jerusalem Mills, and in July of 1864, he and a small troop basically captured two trains at the Magnolia Station, set one of them on fire, and pushed it onto the bridge, the Gunpowder Bridge, which...
Really?
Yes, and burned the drawbridge portion of the bridge at the same time cutting telegraph communication wires and things like that. Basically, they were trying to stop travel between the North and Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., which they succeeded. That train route was closed for about 2 weeks before they could reestablish the drawbridge and everything. But he also captured another Union general who was on sick leave and was on the train that he captured.
What are the odds?
But again, Harry Gilmore was kind of wild and didn't have great control of his troops.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, this Major General Franklin, managed to escape, because the people who were supposed to watch him fell asleep. Even though he had this leg wound, mm-hmm. he managed to like sneak away from his captors who had fallen asleep. And with the help of some locals around Reisterstown, he was taken back into Baltimore and shipped back up towards Philadelphia.
Interesting. So. if you live in the area, the Maryland area or Baltimore County or Harford County, Jerusalem Mills, I know, still once a year, they'll reenact the Harry Gilmore raid. And it's pretty impressive. It's a nice event to take the kids to.
George Cadwalader retired from the military in 1865. He went on to continue. He had tenant farms here. He hired architects to build picturesque gardeners' cottages for his staff.
Now, are we still in the Maxwell Point area?
This is still Maxwell Point area. So he continued to own it until his death in 1879. He never had any children. Mm. Who knows why?
that are accounted
right.
for.
So the property was left to his nephew, John, from his brother, John. and they continued to use the property through the 19-teens when, of course, as we know, in October of 1917, because of World War I.
What happened?
The United States purchased the property from the Cadwaladers to become what would be known as Edgewood Arsenal.
Edgewood Arsenal. Okay. So when Aberdeen Proving Ground, as we know it today, Aberdeen Proving Ground North was purchased by the Army, did they purchase Edgewood as well at the same time, or did that come later?
It was about the same time. It was also in October, but it was a separate event.
Okay.
So there was... because there was a separate reason for acquiring Edgewood. So in 1915, in April, the Germans launched their first gas attack. This was unanticipated by the other Allied troops. Of course, the U.S. wasn't in the First World War at this time. And even though the war was going on, these gas attacks were happening, the U.S. wasn't preparing for war like you would think of us preparing for war today. Mm-hmm. So when the U.S. entered the war in April of 1917, all of a sudden, you have to start thinking about what are we going to do? The gases that were used were not commercially viable, like they didn't have a use outside of warfare. So nobody in the United States was producing them.
Or would produce it because there was no commercial value to it.
There was no commercial value. They were extremely dangerous to try to produce. Mm-hmm. And we have a very interesting report from 1919 that describes the whole entire process of what they had to do to figure out how to produce these gases for chemical warfare. So Edgewood Arsenal, it was originally called Gunpowder Reservation. Mm-hmm. That was the official name of it from October of 1917 until May of 1918 when it became Edgewood Arsenal officially. Mm-hmm. So the whole purpose of it was to produce these chemical gases and then fill them into shells so that they could be dropped onto the enemy soldiers.
Which was extremely dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. These were extremely toxic, horrible materials. At the time when the Army was deciding to create Edgewood Arsenal, they really thought this was going to be the way warfare was going to happen. So there was an enormous need to create the ability to produce these gases and fill them. So very quickly, they started building these plants. They started building these shell-filling plants. There were four main gases that were produced. By the time the war ended, Edgewood had only managed to get two of the production plants online.
Okay.
We were trying, but then the war ended. So most of what was dropped, even by the U.S. troops, were of French production.
Okay.
So the four types of gas were developed and used. They sort of evolved during the course of the war. The first one used by the Germans was chlorine gas, which would affect your lungs. Because of that, nations quickly started to develop gas masks, which could protect you from, you know, inhaling those fumes. And the French and the English both and the Germans all developed gas masks, which would be effective. So then they came up with other types of gas because the gas masks were being used, including chlorpicrin, which was a tear gas, which made your eyes tear up, but it also induced vomiting, which meant that people had to take off their gas masks.
Oh, no.
The other one was phosgene, which would affect your lungs again. It was a heavy gas, so it would really settle into the trenches because you have to remember we were doing trench warfare. And then the last, and which ended up being the one that most people ended up using, was called mustard gas. which was never really a gas. It's a very thick liquid, but it has a heavy blistering effect. It would blister your skin. It would blister your eyes. If you inhaled it, it would blister your lungs. It had a great cause of increasing cancer for people like well after they had been exposed, like 25, 30 years later.
Yeah, that's awful.
So they were really very terrible, terrible things. So after the war, and as I said, we didn't get that much produced before the war ended. They established the chemical warfare section and put them over Edgewood Arsenal in about June. At that point, they sort of started transitioning away from offensive use of chemical weapons to defensive use and to develop protective gear. That's really what Edgewood later became, more focused on the protective side of things and the defensive side. So figuring out ways to counteract the effects, like they basically have to spread lime over areas where mustard gas had been because that would counteract, you know, and clean it because it would linger. So you had to be careful, like even after the attack had happened,
okay,
it would still stick around. So
250 years. That's how long the U.S. Army has stood watch over this great nation, defending our freedom through every storm. In the bloodiest battles of the 20th century, American soldiers answered the call, fighting wherever liberty was at risk. In 1917, as the world was consumed by war, the U.S. Army entered a conflict like no other. In the trenches of France, soldiers faced barbed wire, poison gas, and relentless artillery. At Cantigny, they launched their first major assault. At Saint-Mihiel, they executed a swift and decisive attack, proving American strength. And during the Meuse-Argonne Offensive, the largest battle in U.S. history, they shattered enemy lines, helping bring the war to its end.
Well, just to help our audience, for people who may not be familiar with Army terms, what is known today as APG North, which was a proving ground.
Right.
Where weapons go to be
tested,
proving that they work, and
right,
so on and so on. And 20 miles, is it 20 miles south or 20-minute drive south?
20-minute drive, yeah. I don't know how
but
many miles.
I don't know what you would do. Yeah, I guess we shouldn't research that one.
You take the train.
You take the train. Is Edgewood, which, like you said, was an arsenal.
Right, which meant they were building weapons.
Okay,
That's what an arsenal is. So
yes,
they were creating the gas. They were filling shells. Mm-hmm. So those were two separate processes. And they were pretty much right where industrial part of Edgewood was sort of right where you come in the gate currently, mm-hmm, on Hoadley Road. So if you know the area just south of where the credit union is, it's across from the fire station that's currently there at Edgewood. That area was where the filling plants were. And there was a big power plant, which was the oldest remaining government building on Edgewood, that was meant to power the shell filling plants. So there's still elements of the World War I industry evident today, but it doesn't look anything like it would have back then because this place was hopping.
Yeah.
In 1917, 1918, at the peak, there were 7,400 soldiers at Edgewood because they had to use soldier labor because it was considered too dangerous to use civilians for, mm-hmm, these processes. Because really, to fill the shells, you had to cool the gases so that they would be liquid.
Yeah.
So it was a very involved process. But some of the shell dumps, which were where they would go and they would fill them and they would paint the shells and they would test them to make sure that they didn't leak. Those shell dumps still exist. There's one building that kind of looks, I've always thought it kind of looks like a train station.
Mm-hmm.
That was a hand grenade filling station.
Oh, okay.
And basically the hand grenades were used for like white phosphorus and stuff. It was a smoke screen kind of thing. And I remember when working down there, I had a chemical corps colonel who was in charge of my group. And he remembered being a young soldier and having to go out to the field next to the credit union because it would just start spontaneously smoking. And that was from all the white phosphorus.
Oh, wow.
So they basically had to go like rake it down because that's what it would do. It would produce all this smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So on the east side of Hoadley Road was where the shell filling plants were. And then on the west side of Hoadley Road was where the chemical plants were. And for the most part, those don't exist anymore.
Okay.
there's little bits of parts of buildings and mm-hmm. parts of plants or big buildings and yeah. warehouses and things yeah. like that. But most of the, I mean, it altered over time.
You really don't want to disturb the earth down in Edgewood.
No, you don't.
That's a reminder for anyone who may be living down there.
But you have some interesting family connection, a little bit. It's not really directly to Edgewood, but it's sort of about.
Oh, do I now?
You have something that can really talk about what this chemical warfare meant to soldiers in the field during World War I.
Well, Susan, do I have something very special for you? So my grandfather, his oldest brother, served in World War I. His name was Edward Smith. And his grandsons had discovered, after the death of their father, a trunk from World War I that belonged to Ed. And inside this trunk were many things untouched since probably the war.
Wow.
And since he was a first lieutenant, there were many memo books. Mm-hmm. I think he was an adjutant. But what I found that is pretty unique is it's about a 4x6 address book. It's got a very tattered red cover to it. And inside are just, he almost treats it like a journal. Mm-hmm. There are dates. He is describing the gases that are being used. He's got drawings of trenches mm-hmm. inside here.
It's really a fascinating little book to look at.
It really is. It really is. He even goes back to, now he wasn't over there at the time, and he was stationed in France. But he even writes in here about the first gas attack mm-hmm. that was recorded on 24th of April, 1915 by the Germans. Mm-hmm. And from what I've read, I mean, they're really trying to understand this gas as a weapon. And he's got drawings of cylinders and how to identify certain types of gases. But one thing that really struck me, because I know that Ed was gassed mm-hmm. and did feel the effects of it, and he told his grandchildren it was absolutely horrible. On a page within this journal, it's titled Symptoms: headaches, excruciating, delirious fainting and collapse, loss of power in four limbs, and loss of grip. And at the bottom it reads, don't give a gas victim aspirin for his headache, it will kill him.
Oh my.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a very interesting piece right. of history right here in my hand.
And you go back and you do see that this 1919 report that we have about the construction of Edgewood, and they talk about all the buildings that were built. And one of the buildings that was built was a base hospital mm-hmm. that had 34 buildings, could accommodate up to 300 patients. And they do note that there were at least four fatalities at Edgewood traceable to toxic gas poison, two of those being to phosgene, one to mustard gas, and then an additional fatality outside of the plant, also due to phosgene. So, I mean, you could die.
Oh, yeah.
It was not a fun aspect of anything.
So let me ask you, do you know if we were trying to develop new gases or we were just reproducing what was already known?
We were reproducing what was already known at the time. There was no real innovation here at Edgewood, because actually the Bureau of Mines was in charge of sort of the research and development at the mm-hmm. part, and they had a research facility down at American University. So eventually that was transferred up to Edgewood once they started the Chemical Warfare Service.
Did the organization stay together, or did it become part of the Edgewood Arsenal?
So after World War I, most of the functions were consolidated at Edgewood. There was an early lab at Edgewood, which doesn't exist anymore either.
Are these where the photographs are from?
Yes, we have some photographs from there.
Wonderful, great photograph.
They really had to work to get that lab because they weren't supposed to be doing research, but they got it by saying that they had to evaluate the quality of the gases that were produced.
So, I would think so.
Yeah, so that's how we had a very early World War I lab, even though the research and development part, which is now a hallmark of what happens at APG, did not happen at that point in time. That happened sort of beginning in the 1920s when, you know, the Chemical Warfare Service was established. They took over those research. They took over those protective and offensive measures mm-hmm. because that's really what Edgewood transitioned to be.
So in 1918, Edgewood Arsenal was pretty much the center of the universe for chemical warfare
yes.
within the U.S. Army.
Yes.
I mean, there were other places, but Edgewood was the place.
Right. There were other locations for chemicals being developed, but they were under the control of Edgewood. So there were like commercial plants that they were building or using, but they were under the direction of Edgewood Arsenal. So they were controlling it. And this report actually details, like, and it will say, like, this plant, and they're in different states and things. But
now, did they fall under the command of the ordnance?
Yes. So when the gas service, gas warfare, chemical warfare was first being developed, it was sort of among different services. So gas masks were under the Surgeon General's office. Gas shells were under the Ordnance Department. Toxic gas was under the Trench Warfare section of the Ordnance Department. And the shell-filling machinery was under the Trench Warfare section of the Ordnance Department.
And that was here?
That was all at Edgewood.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So the purpose of Edgewood was twofold: the procurement of toxic gas supplies, either by direct purchase or mm-hmm. developing them, and then the loading of the material into shells, which we talked about. And actually, evidently, the loading was fantastic because there were shells that were sent to France, and when they were assessing them after the fact, there wasn't a single leak or anything. So, I mean, they did a fantastic job filling their shells. So, but the problem with these chemical weapons is that they continue to exist. You know, the U.S.
Yeah, what do you do with them when the war is over you have this stockpile?
So there was a stockpile, and in 2005.
2005?
2005,
they cleared. This episode's about 1918.
Right. So, but that was when the last of the mustard gas stores was cleaned up. So
this was sitting down in Edgewood all this time?
Yes.
There were
chemical weapons that existed from 1918 through 2005 that existed around. So it wasn't a happy, pretty thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like a shiny part of our history. And really,
it was a necessity, though.
A necessity because we were being attacked with gas. So you had to figure out how you can survive that and counter that, which is basically what the U.S. Army was focused on after the World War I. From 1920 forward, it was, as I said, more about offensive and protective measures.
Well, they could have been thinking this is the way we're going. This is the way warfare is now going to be fought with gas.
So, it evolved a lot over, during all the wars. But we still have a strong chemical mission today.
Because we're the best army in the world.
That's right. So we've talked today really about the industrial side of what Edgewood Arsenal was during mm-hmm. World War I. There were certainly other aspects to it. There were World War I barracks, which I was intimately familiar with.
We know.
Because I had my offices there for mm-hmm. a long time. Many of those have now been demolished, which it's very strange to go down there now and see just flatland where there used to be these World War I barracks. But there were other activities that started taking place too, and something that we're going to talk about for our next episode of APG's Hidden History is...
Please do tell.
is the development of, a lot of people have heard about it, but they're not really sure what it is. It's called Fort Hoyle.
Fort Hoyle.
Fort Hoyle, this weird
little
insect.
Blip of history here on the Proving Ground.
Right, but we're going to plan to talk about that and sort of more of the lighter side of Edgewood Arsenal on our next episode.
As we keep chugging along on this very special 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army. So far this season, we've kind of touched on the Revolution.
Right.
We're up to World War I. And
right.
Fort Hoyle, when did that exist?
Fort Hoyle began in the 1920s through the early 1940s. So it was a between the wars kind of activity.
And everything always gets lost when it's between the wars.
That's right. So, but yeah, we touched on our little bit of Civil War.
We did.
Association
we did.
As well. So
we're moving
our way forward.
So by next episode, we should be well into World War II is what I'm thinking.
No, we're going to talk about between the wars next episode.
Okay, let me re-say that. Next time. I am your host, Sean Keefe, along with my co-host, Susan Thompson. Thank you for joining us.